What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to another great episode of The Stoop, where we talk hoops, hoops, and more hoops. I'm your guy, TJ. Thank you to everybody who continues to support the show on all of our pod platforms, man. If you haven't caught the show, make sure you do log in with us, tap in with us, and thank you so much for all the support. Got to give a special shout out to all of our sponsors. First and foremost, our guys at 24/7 Hoops. You need a customized ball as the world opens back up. You got a church league, an AAU league, whatever it is got going on. We got an official ball for you, 24/7 Hoops. Shout out to my guy, Dave, takes care of us, man. Hope he can take care of you too. Secondly, we got to shout out Yave Tequila. Again, I get your Yave drink on for the summer and the spring coming to you soon. They got it in mango. They got it in regular. And they also got it in habanero, aka that pepper spice to you guys. Thank Joe and Ron for all their love too with Yave Tequila. Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the stoop today, it took time for this one to happen, but I'm so ecstatic that it is. We're talking about a journalist. We're talking about a historian about basketball, a hooper himself. You've catched him on the Undefeated on so many different ESPN platforms, but we have him right here on the stoop for a very, very special reason. His book that recently came out, I Came in the Shadows, just everybody from Bill Clinton, the president himself, to Tom, New York Times have been just in raving about the book, and he's so gracious enough to grant us some time to be on here today. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Mr. Jesse Washington. Mr. Washington. Jesse, thank you so much for coming to us today, man.
Man, it's great to be here, man. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, you know, I got to ask you this question. You know, a lot of times they say, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? What came first for you, your love of basketball or your love of journalism?
Ooh, wow. No one has asked me that question. That's a great one, man. I would probably say a love of reading came first. Okay. My parents, put all kinds of printed matter in front of me all the time. My parents chose not to have a television in the house. While we were growing up, you know, we were only missing out on three channels anyway, because that's all we had back then. Right. But then the love of basketball came very quickly after that. And I've been fortunate to combine those into doing some things that feel meaningful to me and hopefully to other people.
But you also are a hooper yourself, man. So when did you first fall in love with the sport? Who first put the ball in your hand?
Oh, man. You know, my pops was a weird dude. He was a different cat, very creative. I get a lot of my creative energies from him, but he didn't care about sports. Mind you, this is a 6'4", 6'5", black man from Philly. So very, very different. But just being around in the neighborhood, man, you know, I think when I really got the bug was when we moved out of Brooklyn and we moved to Poughkeepsie, New York, Eastman Projects, right next to Tubman Terrace Apartments, basketball court right there. That was where it was at. That was where it was popping. This is the early to mid 80s. That was where the turntables got plugged into the light posts. Yeah, and the center of the neighborhood was the basketball court, and guys were getting it in. I wanted to be a part of that. I couldn't be a part of that because I was a shorty. So the shorties had to get in when it was dark and the lights went out, or in between games, you put up a quick shot. That was really when sort of the whole thing came together. You know how it is, man. Mm-hmm. It's basketball, it's hip hop, it's our culture, it's our neighborhoods, and they all sort of go together and flow together. That's where it really came together for me. Eastman Projects, Poughkeepsie, New York, mid 80s.
We're going to delve into some things, but I thank you for that answer. Let's delve into things. We're talking about iconic figures before we even get to the book and Big Coach, but this has to do with Big Coach. Where do you think we are in the landscaping of sports? And I say this because recently we lost Big Coach, and then we lost the late great, my coach, John Chaney, Nola Richardson. There were eras where we had these bigger than life black figures that roamed the sidelines. Will we ever get there again? Will there ever be poignant individuals that stand up for what's right that are iconic like those brothers were?
Man, you know, I think that Those giants were one of a kind, and they will never be duplicated. However, I think that the example that they set lives on, but not at that college level. I think there's too much money involved at the college level. I think that the pressure to win is too great. I think that they don't give coaches the opportunity to not be successful, as Coach says in the book. But I think that there are many, many John Thompsons and John Chaneys and Nolan Richardsons at the community level. Still. And Coach Thompson got it from the community level and then really developed that. So I think in every hood you go to, there's men who are coaching because they love youth. They love education. They love helping people, and they're doing it for the right reasons. And they're like pillars of their community. They're helping countless people. So I do think that we have them. Just because they're not celebrities, you know, doesn't mean that they're not making a huge impact. I hope that we see another John Thompson come across the landscape. But to be honest with you, if you scan the horizon, there's a lot of really good quality brothers, but you have to win and you have to have that emphasis on education. Like, how can you have an emphasis on education now when the whole point is just to stay in college and hoop as short a time as possible?
Absolutely, you know? Absolutely.
So I don't know.
Got it. Let's talk about something else, because I think about the lore of what the IEs, the Temples and the Georgetowns, and more so, they were iconic in their areas. You're talking about your father from Philadelphia. I went to Temple University. I knew how iconic, number one, John Chaney was in the community, prolific in North Philadelphia. But let's talk about what Big Coach meant to the DC metro area. I'm talking about Chocolate City. I'm talking about them legendary 80s. How instrumental was he just to the culture? The school was to the culture, the culture being influenced by the area and the location of DC as well.
Right. So number one, John Thompson was a proud, proud Washingtonian. And he loved his city. He was proud of the heritage. The thing that he was most proud about in terms of strictly basketball accomplishments was the fact that out of all the great players to come out of DC, he's probably the only one to win championships in high school, college, the NBA, the Olympics, and then a coaching championship. Wow. So that's that about DC. And then he always represented for DC basketball. He recruited the heck out of it. He brought so many great players to light. Right. Really, if we think about, you know, the modern version of DC, including PG County and all that, like, he laid the bricks for that are still being built upon today. So it just became a huge point of pride. And then the thing was, is Georgetown was always the white school that didn't really mess with us like
yes.
that.
Yes.
So to see a black man go over there and then bring all the brothers from around the way, Spingarn, you know, Dunbar, Baltimore, you know, you could throw Baltimore into that mix. And so to see him do what he did for the city from this traditionally white school that didn't really rock with DC like that, he was right. The bridge between these white elite institutions and our people and our right. neighborhoods and our values and our culture. And so he really set the foundation for that and lived it like nobody before or since.
Yes, yes.
And he never left.
Nah, he stayed.
He never
stayed
left.
With it. And that was the thing. One of the questions I got for future was, since we're there, why don't you think Big Coach never really jumped to the league? We had Patino do it. We had so many great coaches try it because they had a great track record in collegiate sports, collegiate basketball, more specifically. But why don't you think Big Coach ever made that jump, or maybe might have toiled with it but never really did it?
Yeah, he had plenty of offers, and the most serious one came. There was a couple of brothers. This is in the 90s. Who bought a stake in the Denver Nuggets. So if Coach is going to go to the league, he's going to go work for the black guys who own a squad. So he seriously thought about it. But and he didn't delve into it too much in his book. It wasn't too much on his mind. But based on what he said in our conversations, I believe he didn't go because his primary goal in life was to be a teacher and to help develop young people. Develop as leaders, as people to contribute something to the world, develop their minds. And when you're a professional coach, your only job is to win. And you don't really get to deal with the players other than the time that they're there practicing or playing. These are grown men, and other than that, they go on their way. But Coach, you know, shoot, his job really started when the whistle blew at the end of practice, you know. So I think that's why he didn't go to the league, is because he always wanted to be a teacher. He never intended to be a coach. He wanted to work with young people, and that's why he stayed in college.
Definitely. I want to specifically talk to you, or the author of the piece, I Come as a Shadow. You know, I want to shout out Mr. Ron. That's a great gentleman to me, and father of his family, one of his sons, and JT3 as well, for me being my years of being the team's host. What was it like when they invited you in? Because they don't expose the curtain. They don't pull that boy back at all. And you know that, Jesse, like, they're a very coveted, very powerful family. But what was that for you, maybe A, for that first initial phone call when you reached out and you wanted to start working on a project, and then actually getting inside and saying, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, once I got the gig, I was in, but I wasn't really in.
Right.
You know, I had the rock, but Coach could have blew the whistle and benched me at any minute. You know what I'm saying?
Definitely.
I felt like I had to earn it every day. And every time I came to work, every time I wrote a page for him, every time I came to do an interview with him, I was ready to earn that trust and respect. And it came very gradually. So in the early going, you know, one time, probably the third time we sat down to talk, and I just mentioned, you know, I would have topics I would try to bring up to get him to talk about. I said, yeah, coach, well, you know, you're not somebody who trusts people very right. easily. He said, I don't trust people. He said, I don't trust you. And he looked me dead in my face. But over time, I believe that he came to because I earned it with hard work, with being prepared. And probably it was a good solid year, maybe year and a half. His daughter Tiffany joked recently that it was right when the book, you know, got sent to the printer that he was like, okay, I could work with this kid, Jesse. You know, he's kept my confidence. He's done what I've asked him to do. He hasn't been out talking about everything that's going on. You know, coach had a lot of health problems over the last, you know, time that we worked together, but all that was, you know, kept in house. Yeah. And so I valued that and respected it because I know how hard it is to earn it. And I know how seriously he took it and how few people he gave it to. His favorite player, Patrick Ewing, mentioned offhand that coach was in the hospital and coach got mad and cussed Patrick out. So I was like, yeah, I ain't going to let that be me. Yeah. So, you know, but I considered it a privilege and a responsibility. When coach gives you that trust, you have to make sure that you use it appropriately. And that's what I tried to do.
Definitely. We appreciate you and applaud you for that. Coach had an idea and a concept to create an identity, one of which we've never seen in the landscape of sports. Georgetown is nicknamed Big Man U. Talk about that and talk about, you know, you could have did anything else in the world, but that was his calling card. Talk about that for a second.
Yeah, so Big Man U. You know, coach said one time we were talking about basketball in the modern game and stuff like that. And coach said, yeah, you know, all these three-pointers. He said, I think they should give you 3 points for a layup. He said, a layup is easier to make, but harder to get. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And so he was definitely, you know, a big man, you know, a lover of post play and of throwing the ball down there and going to work. But also when coach played, and here's something that I sort of discovered, shoot, his senior year, coach was All-American. Coach averaged 26 and 15.
Yeah.
You know, and coach was sort of like a mobile big. He was like, he would be sort of, you know, a stretch four-ish in today's games, although he was definitely in the post doing his thing. So, you know, Big Man U came from the fact that I think first he got one of the all-time great players in basketball history and perhaps the greatest college basketball player we've ever seen in Patrick Ewing. And then that snowball, because Patrick went there, Alonzo wanted to go there. Right. And then he sort of lucked out into Dikembe, which is a funny story in the book about that. You know, so then you got three of the best big men ever to come through one school. And then you got coach himself. And it was an image and an aura. Now, coach did get mad when people said he could only coach bigs. Yeah. You know, and he would rattle off. He's like, hey, OK, look at, you know, all the guys I sent to the NBA. Allen Iverson, Charles Smith, you know, draft picks upon draft picks upon draft picks, you know. So don't tell me I could just coach big men. Yeah. So, but I think that the aura that he really cultivated was one of black pride, you know, and of black empowerment, you know, and of being unapologetic in our blackness. He was ahead of his time. Like, that's what we talk about now, right?
Right.
Like, you know, like really owning who you are and being unapologetically black. I mean, shoot, if you really think about it, coach was Black Lives Matter
before it was
30 years ago.
Yeah, before it was something. Yeah.
Right. Because he was saying, hey, man, look at these young men as people and as human beings. And I'm a man. So don't just reduce me to what I could do, how fast I could run or how high I could jump. So that to me was the biggest aura that he cultivated, in addition to being the greatest big man university in college basketball.
Yeah. You know, big coach used to critique me about my jokes because I used to lie to get the audience riled up, man. He'd be like, young man, nice job tonight, but you still got to work on these jokes. And every time I would go to the elevator, I said, big coach, I got you. Just come back next game. I'll be in here. He said, I'm going to be watching for you. I think about what you just said about being black and being prideful. Him and my father had a conversation because my father understood what big coach meant to the black community. Not a lot of people see that as being historic. He set history becoming the first coach at Georgetown in his role. but he meant a lot of things to the Black community that a lot of times went unnoticed. My father served in Vietnam, and he understand at that time, he didn't see people like John Thompson. And when he came home and he saw John Thompson in capacity as a coach, it did something for Black America. Talk about that particular situation in terms of him getting that role. Because like I said, you said earlier, Georgetown being Georgetown, and Georgetown has done a lot to even take care of reparations and the slavery issues in Louisiana and just so many things that coach is an icon in the Black community that sometimes we forget about.
Absolutely. So before I go there, I want to say, number one, that I know coach, even though he didn't say it, but based on my interactions with him, he was tremendously proud to see you in there doing the job that you were doing and succeeding through your intellect and thinking fast and coming up with things like that. He valued that. He loved to see young Black people doing those kind of things. So he was proud of you. And also, coach would have been super proud. He would have been like, oh, that boy got sponsors on his show. Like, yeah, go ahead and make that money. Like, coach was all about that. He loved that.
Yeah,
one of his favorite stories, like, and when you held up the basketball and had the logo, one of coach's favorite stories was after they won the chip and then they went to the White House and took a picture for the cover of Sports Illustrated with Ronald Reagan. Yeah. And they were holding the basketball. And coach said that he kept moving it. So the he represented Wilson basketball.
Yeah.
So he said to Wilson, yeah, how much if I get your logo on the cover of Sports Illustrated? And he kept turning the logo to make sure the logo was in the picture. And the photographer was like, hey, move that around. And he said Reagan was laughing because he knew what Thompson was doing. And Coach Thompson's ball, all three of them are holding the ball. His is the only one where you can see the logo.
Yeah.
So much respect to you for the sponsorships. He would love that. So, you know, what he represented to the Black community, it's hard to really overstate it, you know, because we didn't see anybody in that type of leadership position. You know, like we in the Obama era now. So a Black man has been president and we've had a John Thompson and a John Cheney and a Colin Powell and, you know, and on and on and on. You know, we got Michael Jordan owning a team now, you know, but back then in the 80s, man, like I'm telling you, as a child of the 80s, like you did not see Black people in positions of authority. And, you know, I'm generalizing, but not by much. Mm-hmm. And certainly not at a university like Georgetown.
Right.
So just to see him there in charge, and also a lot of the dudes that we saw in charge took on really the ways and the mannerisms of the white man.
Yeah.
You know, man, there was a clip where Coach Thompson was on Ted Koppel's Nightline. And they had a guy on television. So this is probably, it was during the whole Rafel thing. So it was about 89. And they had a brother there from the DEA. Uh-huh. And when he came on, his voice sounded just like Eddie Murphy's imitation of a white man. And so like, that was how we sort of, and it's not, you know, I don't blame the Black men. Our people were trying to get ahead any way we could, you know? So I'm not saying that, like, you know, I'm not calling them Uncle Toms or anything like that. It was just the environment that a lot of Black people who were in trying to ascend those highest levels forced them to change their ways and their mannerisms, but not John Thompson and not his basketball teams. And so to me, that's his biggest representation in terms of why he became such an icon in the Black community, is that he did it and refused to change who he was, especially in response to criticism.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, your squads are too rough. They're a bunch of thugs. They're about a bunch of hoodlums. Coach was like, nah, play harder. You know, right. Play harder. We're not going to change who we are just because you guys are misunderstanding or stereotyping us. So, you know, I think that's why it was so important to folks like your father to come and see that. It was revolutionary, the way he coached and what he represented and how he was able to bring the athleticism and the excellence, but also the intellectualism to the whole package. And it was like nothing we had ever seen, man. I loved it growing up. I was like, man, who is that? Who is that team? How do I, can I read more about him? Like, that's what I want to see some more of. So he changed the whole game, changed the expectation and the of Black people in America.
This gray and navy blue, I knew what it was before I really even knew what the game of basketball was, because I had, like I said, my father, I had uncles, I had cousins that just gravitated to the Georgetown brand, and seeing this historic, larger than life figure, literally and figuratively, as I would call him a gentle giant. Because when you get to get down through the hard exterior, big coach. He was a great, genuine person, individual.
Absolutely.
Lover of all mankind, literally.
Yes.
People don't see that, well, they do. People don't really see how valued as a savior Big Coach was. I heard certain stories from people saying once Big Coach would come in their living room and he would either duck down to get into the house and sit down and talk to soon-to-be players' parents, that right away, instantaneously, they said, you know what, boy, you going to Georgetown, because that man not only going to make sure you work hard, but it's going to start in the classroom. You know, ironically, it's always, we look at the Chuck story with AI about, you know, how he came in the situation being with AI, but it's more than just AI, and I want you to give some gravitation to that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It was way more than AI and Patrick, and some of his closest relationships throughout his whole life that I witnessed before he died were with players that I had never heard of.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the number one example is a guy named Mr. Lonnie Duren. So Lonnie Duren was Bebe Duren's older brother. Bebe was one of the best players in DC, helped really put Georgetown into that echelon of knocking on the door to Final Four. Bebe was the first MVP of the Big East when the conference was first formed.
Right.
His older brother Lonnie was not as good a player, but he had a role on the team, and Coach loved that man. And I witnessed the depth of their relationship and how much he loved him and how much they cared for each other and how much he supported him, how much he continued to do. And he was like, I love that little boy. Like he said, I knew Lonnie since before he could cross Third Street by himself, you know? And so he scooped him up and put him on the squad. And he had a role. He contributed to their success. And then later went on to do great things that had nothing to do with basketball. And Coach says in his book, I'm as proud of what Lonnie Duren did as I am of Patrick Ewing going to the Hall of Fame. You know, and so there were dozens and dozens of people like that. There were dozens of people like that who Coach helped who didn't even go to Georgetown.
Facts.
Helped them go to another school.
No
helped
doubt.
Them get a job over here.
Yes, indeed.
You know, and so like a savior, that was what like his mission was to help people. You know, and Coach came up in Boys Club Number 2 in Washington D.C. under Mr. Jabbo Kenner, Mr. Julius Wyatt, and Mr. Butler. I forgot Mr. Butler's first name. Coach never called them by their first names, even as an elderly man. And so these were community servants, man. And they were saving kids every day. And Coach saw that and witnessed it and benefited from it. And he was like, I want to be that, you know, in another context. But that he never lost that. So for every AI, you know, or great player that he, quote unquote, saved, there's probably five more that we've never heard of that he also saved, you know, and did a lot for. So that's really a credit for him. You know, Coach was a complex dude and he would acknowledge the contradictions and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Coach would say, yeah, you know, I want to recruit this kid because he was a great player, but he didn't talk about the ones who he helped out and gave a scholarship to just who weren't great players.
Definitely. And people don't even realize his loyalty because he talked about Mr. Kenner a lot. They even named the Summer League the Kenner League after Mr. Kenner. So that's how crazy thing was. And like Big Coach always praised and showed love to everybody that was instrumental to him as well. Georgetown in 1985 went on to be a national champion. In your opinion, I've seen a lot of your contemporaries, a lot of your colleagues, only ranked that team number 10 all time in college basketball. And I kind of shake my head at that because if you look at that squad from top to bottom, the pros that were on that team, the power that that team had, I can't give them 10. But I'm just curious to see what your thoughts is on that.
Yeah, that's way too low. that's way too low.
Okay.
So ask Billis, you know, he would know. You know, here's the thing. I think that we tend to look at the players in college as in terms of their greatness as what those players did once they got to the NBA, you know, and what they became later. But that team concept that Coach Thompson had, shoot, their subs were crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Their subs would have beat most squad. Their second five could have beat most teams in the country. As a matter of fact, Coach said in his book, sometimes I had to stop practice because the second five was whipping the first five's butts,
mm-hmm.
like killing them. Michael Jackson, underappreciated talent. Michael Jackson could have went to any other school and averaged 20, 25 a game.
Yes,
easy. Indeed. But he came to Georgetown to be part of something bigger to and sacrificed so much of his game, even to the point where it affected his pro career. Because, you know, when you're coming out as a scoring guard, you know, or as, you know, or as a backup point guard, it's a big difference in your career. But he wanted to do that. That's the type of man that Michael Jackson is. And so I think that team could have played with anybody. The other thing that people that sort of results in them being bumped down a few notches is that Villanova got lucky and beat them in the 85 chip after Georgetown won in 84, and then Nova beat them in 85 and then 86, whatever it was. Right. I said it, Villanova got lucky.
They did.
You know what I'm saying? So
absolutely.
To some people, they did. I mean, come on. Like they shot 75% for the game. You know what I'm saying? 90% in the second half. So, you know, I can't think of many teams that would be able to beat Georgetown, period, point blank.
No.
You know, that Georgetown team that won it had everything.
Yeah, in any era.
In any era. Any era.
Let's talk platforms, because you, with the Undefeated, you with ESPN, you as a journalist, as a historian, have been prolific. You know, Jesse, these last 24 months, if we look at our world, sometimes it would be hard to just even watch the news, digest what we were seeing. But before I get into that, I want to take a step back, because this logo right here, you had something to say that was daunting when you talking about Mike and Republican wears shoes too. Because I did my research on you, brother. I was excited about today. I'm ready for you. In 1991, I was a young fella, super young fella. And I remember my mom being in tears, watching Ted Koppel replay and air the Rodney King beating. And we got a chance during the quarantine to listen to Mike talk about Mike with The Last Dance. And I had on the show, and I'm gonna quickly get to it, another guest. And we were talking about Mike. And I said, in 1991, to watch that footage, you gotta still be quiet. I understand the brand. I understand who you are. I understand what the jump man means. I get all of that. But as a black man, who is Mike? We talking Gatorade, McDonald's, Nike, everything. You gotta still be quiet? I'm just curious, given what I had to say just now, how does that resonate to you? And talk about that, because like I said, you've been deliberate. And we're gonna talk about some more things, but you've been deliberate about discussing some of these factors and race and social justice in the last 24 months yourself.
Yeah, absolutely, man. That's a great topic. And it's complicated. There's a lot of facets to it.
Right.
And so number one, Michael Jordan deserves to live his life however he sees fit. And also Michael Jordan has done as much to help black people in his own way.
Yes, he has.
As you know, anybody I could think of.
Just donated now, a meal to Morehouse. Absolutely.
Just gave, right, boom. You know, and then yeah. In terms of, you talking about that Jumpman logo. So Michael Jordan has economically empowered, you know, look at the executives that he's made sure that you know, Jordan brand as a company employs, promotes, and cultivates black leadership.
Absolutely.
With his NBA franchise, he has hired people, you know, so that's his form of activism for most of his life. But yes, he was silent on these things. And I think we have to look at it in the context. So, number one, Coach Thompson defended Michael Jordan to the end.
Yes, he did.
And Coach Thompson did not tell me this. I heard this from somebody else.
Okay.
And who was definitely in a position to know that when Jordan was getting criticized for not being vocal, for staying silent during the Rodney Kings, he called Coach Thompson and asked for advice. And Coach Thompson basically said, you don't have to, you do what you think is best and blankety blank the rest of these blankety blankers. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, don't be pressured by what they feel you should do. So that's one side of it.
Right.
On the other side, Jordan did make a decision to protect his brand and to stay silent on controversial racial issues. And I do think we have to look at it in context. And this is a subject that you alluded to the article that I wrote, really examining this dynamic with Michael and how he talked about it, and this infamous quote that he had that we were never really sure if he said it or not. And in The Last Dance, he said that he said it as a joke, which was when explaining why he didn't delve into racial politics. He said Republicans buy sneakers too, right? So at that time, in that context, there was actually a risk of him being able to get to a point where he could hire all these black people if he took those stances. No black man had been able to succeed at that level before. The only other comparable corporate pitch man was OJ, and OJ said, I'm not black, I'm OJ. Mike was always unapologetically black, but he felt that he had to take his stance, and that was the smart business decision. And while I would love to see him leading the charge out there, we got to respect what he's done. And now he's in a position to give $1 million to Morehouse, to hire more black executives than anybody else, to no longer stay silent. You know, Michael Jordan, we had a big exclusive with the Undefeated some years ago where he said, I can no longer stay silent. And these are the words of Michael Jordan himself. I can no longer stay silent. No longer means I used to be silent. So, you know, everybody deserves a chance to evolve and grow and change how they are. Absolutely. He got the bag and then he's repping. Even though it is crazy to think now that when Rodney King happened, that Magic, Michael, none of these guys addressed it.
Everybody was quiet. And I'm looking at this at the time, like I said, this is what heated me. We talking about 9 officers that were acquitted. We talked about that man's face was so swollen, you had to really look at him to identify who he was. Orbital bones fractured and everything else. And let's be clear, if that gentleman did not walk out onto his balcony that night, we would have never saw that. That would have just been one of the ones that, like, they just got swept under the rug at those times. So I do thank Mike for what he's done now, but if I ever got a chance to see Mike and meet Mike and say, was that hard for you to digest at the time? I'm just curious. Because as a black man, I think I might have had to blow the whistle on that one.
It may have been, but you know, he made a decision. He had like a policy, basically. I don't talk about these things. You know, I don't talk about them. I don't advocate for them. That's not what I'm doing. I'm gonna work in another avenue. You know, black progress has always proceeded on many parallel tracks. And there have been different approaches to solving these problems and gaining more equality. And in my opinion, they sort of work in concert. You need, like, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King had very different approaches and even animosity, but they were both working for the same goal and they both helped get us there. So the things that Mike was doing in his economic activism, coupled with the outspoken people, you know, to me, I'm rocking with that. I mean, here's an analogy for you. When Coach Thompson got to Georgetown, there was a black man on campus who was like a mascot. He was like a lawn jockey. His name was Pebbles. It was a tremendously heartbreaking story. But Coach said Pebbles was responding to the environment that he was in. And I don't resent Pebbles for being that way. As a matter of fact, I might have acted that way if I was in his situation. You know, so that Coach had a large capacity to forgive. And so I think that, you know, Michael Jordan was in an unprecedented situation of being a dark-skinned black man with massive global appeal, able to build a legendary, one of the most iconic brands in world history.
Yes, indeed.
And so that's what he was thinking about. I don't begrudge him making the choice to stay silent on those things at that time. You know, that was his choice, and I respect his ability to make that choice. But he did stay silent. So let the record show, the record is what it is.
Yes.
You know, and he didn't, you know, he has to live with that. We have to, you know, to feel however we feel about it. And that's part of his legacy, you know, and he evidently feels that he wishes that he had spoke out because he said, I can no longer stay silent. And now he's not.
Absolutely.
Great topic, bro. Great topic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I got 4 more quick questions and I'm gonna get out your way. Jesse, real quick.
Yeah, let's do it.
First one is this. Last 24 months, like I said, you've been active. You've been writing some great pieces and talking about what's been going on in our climate. The question I have for you is, should we have jumped into that bubble? And since the bubble, have we lost the message?
Yes, we should have gone into the bubble. I do think that they had a bigger platform to get more of the message off. And there's always a danger of it being corporatized and sanitized. And like, you could have this slogan on your jersey, but You can't have that one, you know. So there's always a danger of that. But with no games, with no TV, there's no platform. So when Jacob Blake got shot, if there was no games, they wouldn't have been able to shut down the league. And that was a powerful statement that those brothers made.
Yes.
Powerful statement. No, we're not playing for your amusement right now. There's more important things going on. So I do think that they should have. Have we lost the message? I don't think so. I think that the athletes have been awakened for good. And that I think that they're doing a lot of things off the court, you know, in the field that we don't necessarily see. I think they're giving money to causes, you know, and I think that they have the importance and the responsibility that they have with their wealth and their influence, I think has really been hammered home. And I think the bubble helped to bring them together in an atmosphere of unity. Look at what the WNBA did during the bubble. And they maintain that sense of unity. So I don't think that we've lost the message. You know, I mean, it does sort of rub you the wrong way. And the great Bill Roden, who's my colleague, I'm his colleague at the Undefeated, is a strong critic of, you know, these empty gestures. You know what I'm saying? And we've all seen all of corporate America is all like, you know, black is the best thing out now, you know, for the next 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. So, but no, I don't think they've lost the message, man. I think that a lot of these brothers have been awakened and changed and will continue to do good in their communities and are ready. You know, hey, Coach Thompson said it, the threat of the riot, the fear of the riot is more powerful than the riot itself.
Yes, indeed.
So now that they shut down the league once, they're like, hey, don't we might mess around and shut it down again.
Absolutely.
We already showed you we could do it. Yes. So I think they put the fear of the riot in some of these cats and they need it.
I definitely think so. And I think, you know, people are woken to the fact that they just not going to shut up and dribble no more. Like if they're not feeling something, we out. We're going to sit down and let y'all figure it out. We'll come back when, you know, it's looking the right way again. And I do appreciate that. You know, the Bill Russell has documented this. Casey Jones has documented this. And we've seen something that happened this week in basketball, you know, with Kyrie asking, let's keep it basketball, but talking about the underlining element of race in basketball, more so race in Boston, but race in some of these areas that we kind of turn a blind eye to. And even though he retired today, you know, Danny Ainge went on record this past week of saying, I wasn't aware that these things were happening in Boston. Danny Ainge, you played in the Garden. You played with Chief and DJ. You heard these things, but we're going to act like it didn't happen. When do we really, really look at the issues that we have in our pro sports leagues? When do we really define things to say, you know what, these issues do exist? I know you're not probably going to look at this correctly, but I'm going to use the NFL and looking at, you know, what Roger Goodell said, you know, and trying to be apologetic for what happened with Colin Kaepernick. What is it going to take for us to really come to grips with what's existing in our sports culture? And who needs to stand up and say something and be honest and be transparent about these issues that exist with our teams?
Yeah, I think what it's gonna take is more black ownership, more black power and control and influence. And we're starting to see that, you know, players have never had more power and influence than they have right now. We have Jordan as an owner.
Do you think blacks are being blocked though? You know, we've had people form groups and groups still get denied and they put in a petition to become ownership. Is it still just a good old boys network? Pardon me for saying it, but I'm gonna put it out there.
Yes.
Like,
yeah, I think you're right.
Okay.
I think we're being systemically blocked.
Okay.
You know, and at the end of the day, it is a club. And if you want to buy a team, the rest of them dudes have to vote you in.
Right.
I mean, that's what it is.
Call it what it is. Okay.
Call it what it is. So I think that's a great point, you know, and that's the, you know, they're holding on to the last shred of you know of influence and power, and that you know, you can extend that analogy out, you know, past sports, but specifically in the NBA, I think that's what it's going to take for us to, you know, this country, I'm not going to generalize that much, but large parts of this country do not want to confront the realities of our history or how it is right now, and they want to minimize or rationalize or explain away these things. And so until we have more black ownership in sports to really make it untenable for these things to happen, and until we just really continue to keep pushing the ball forward in terms of explaining the historical accuracy of and realities of where we come from and where we're at right now, then we'll continue to have these problems. I'm glad that they finally called it out, you know, and the fact that Kyrie could say that and say, hey, it is what, and even if you watch the press conference, he sort of tiptoed around it until someone off campus, you know. So, and I get it, man, it's a business. It's a business. And the players don't want to kill the golden goose, you know, or the goose that laid the golden eggs. And them eggs is golden right now. Them cats is caking up. So, you know, and more power to them, you know, more power to them. So, you know, I think it's going to take more insistence, more unapologetic statements, and more confronting the realities and more Black ownership and influence and leverage in order to move past all this stuff.
Definitely, definitely. Listen, Jesse Washington, thank you so much for being on the stoop with us today, man. I really, really appreciate you. But before you go, I got one final question to ask you. You've had the opportunity to sit down with Coach Thompson, rest in peace, big coach, for a substantial amount of time as you documented his journey and came up with a masterful work of art. If I had to give you 10 slots, who would be on your all-time Georgetown roster? I got you. You the coach.
Ooh, okay.
You got
okay.
10. You got 10 slots to fill.
Right. So not in order.
Any no position, no order, no nothing.
Right. Not in order. But you know, you started. So you start with the four Hall of Famers: Patrick, Alonzo, Dikembe, AI. That's okay. Easy, right? Okay. Michael Jackson.
Okay.
Right. Michael Jackson got to be on there. Bebe Duren.
Okay.
Okay. An unknown contributor, Derrick Jackson.
Okay.
Derrick Jackson, go look him up. Hit the buzzer beater as a freshman to send him to their first NCAA tournament in 30-something years and 70-whatever. You know, coach called him my mortgage. Okay, so that's seven. You got Derrick Jackson. We got Bebe in there. You probably have to put Craig Big Sky Shelton because that was the team after Derrick Jackson's team that really – took them to the tournament every year, got them to the Elite Eight, should have went to the Final Four. You got to put Sleepy Floyd. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Sleepy Floyd. You got to put Sleep. You got to put Sleep. Yeah. Coach said in his book that when Sleepy was missing shots, he'd be like, hey, yo, Coach, man, there's something wrong with these rims. and he said he was serious. He'd be like, nah, Coach, I mean, the ball's not going in. The rims, you go check them rims, Coach. So that's nine. And then for number 10, I'm going to put Charles Smith, Smitty. Charles Smith.
Okay.
Who coach said hit more big shots in the history of Georgetown basketball than anybody, including Patrick and AI.
Mm.
And he didn't even want to recruit Smitty. He did it as a favorite. He was left out. He was like, oh, he too little. He not. And then he wouldn't even play him. He wouldn't even play Charles Smith. And then a couple dudes got injured or fouled out. He threw him in the game, said, look, don't shoot the ball. Kid finished with 22. Yeah. in an NCAA tournament off the bench. Absolutely. So there it is.
I'm gonna give you five honorable mentions right now.
Yeah. Okay. Go for it.
I'm gonna give you five honorable mentions. I want you to add in five more people.
Yeah. Yep. Who? Oh, I get five. Okay.
Yeah, five
okay.
More
so
mentions.
So yeah. Okay. So shoot. Wow. Man. Whew. Okay, so this is just coaches players because okay. You got a whole nother, you know, you got a right. lot of other good, you know, great players too. You know, Uncle Jeff Green still doing it out here, you know. But just coaches players, man, I have all this goodwill built up now. You know, Georgetown Hoya Nation loves your boy. I'm about to lose it all, but I'm up for the challenge.
I got you.
So, man, well. Probably got to pick somebody from the earliest teams, you know, like Derrick Jackson was one of those first ones, but he got there in 72. So probably like a Merlin Wilson or a Jonathan Long, like one of them cats from the early 70s who really helped him get the ball rolling up front. So that's one, probably Jaren Jackson, you know, you got to, you know, Jaren Jackson senior, you know what I'm saying? You know, and then, you got your boy worried now. I'm just gonna go for the championship squad. I mean, you got to put
Reggie Williams.
You know?
Yeah,
you got to put Reggie. You know, and then you know, like, who do you pick out of like whole?
You got like, Sweet. You got Jahadi White. You got Roy Hibbert. You got Greg Monroe.
Right. You know, you got that, but they're more after Coach's era,
right?
You know, so I'm only dealing with the John Coach's Thompson era. Hoyas.
John Thompson Hoyas, right? Okay, good.
I mean, like
Vic don't get a slot. Vic don't get a slot.
Whoo!
Vic don't get a slot.
Yeah, Vic probably got to get a slot. Vic got to get a slot. I mean, that boy right there.
When AI put his hat in the ring that next year, Vic got busy. Nobody even seen that coming.
He did. He did get busy. And then, you know, if there's one more, I mean, probably somebody from those Hoyas. Like, do you put Mike, you know, Michael Graham only? You might put him in there, you know. But probably I would do one of the guys. You know what? I'm gonna throw a defender in there.
Okay.
You know, I'm gonna throw Gene Smith.
Oh,
I'm gonna just throw Gene Smith.
Gene Smith.
Shout to Gene Smith.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, like one of the and Coach said, quick Gene Smith story. He went over to what's that school in D.C. You know, that where Gene was playing to recruit a big dude, and he saw Gene. He said Gene came in like to practice and immediately started running laps. Like just to get in shape. And he wanted to recruit Gene, but he didn't want anybody to know he was recruiting Gene. So he acted like he was recruiting the big fella. And then when he went to the high school coach, he was like, yo, I'm trying to offer Gene a scholarship. He was like, what are you talking about? He's going to Morgan State. And he was like, nah, he coming to Georgetown with me. And he said he had a picture in his mind. He said, if I get Gene Smith on the ball, applying ball pressure, my whole defense will fall into place around that. You know, it all fought. So I'm gonna throw Gene Smith in there. Shout out to Gene Smith, best defender. Coach said the best on the ball defender he had next to Mike Riley. Mike Riley, you know, Mike Riley, another great defender. Uh-huh. He said all Mike Riley wanted to do was play defense. He said he would just want to take the ball from you, give it back to you, let you try again, take it from you, give it back. He said Mike Riley would come in the game, and as soon as he made a steal, the whole student section would yell out, got it.
Oh, man. Well, listen.
So, I'm sorry about all the dudes that I missed. A lot of too many great players to mention.
Way
but
too
that,
many.
That's a great question. So I'm going to finish with a question for you.
Sure.
You had a lot of, you know, we share something that we were privileged to actually meet John Thompson and have conversations with him. So what's your favorite John Thompson story that you'd like to leave the listeners with?
Oh, man. My first year, 2017. And he was sitting on the sideline, and I was coming in to the arena, and we hadn't spoke yet. I was too in shock to even talk to him because of his aura. Syracuse versus Georgetown, biggest ticket in town, sold out, thousands of people in Capital One Arena. I'm walking past him. He said, hey, excuse me, young man, come here for a second. And I'm still looking this way, right? And he's behind me, and my eyes got big like a deer headlight. And I turn around, I said, I'm sorry, sir, beg your pardon. Host boy, come in, host, come in. I said, yes, sir, big coach, how you doing today? He said, I'm gonna tell you one thing. I really don't care for these orange SOBs, and you better make sure this crowd is into it from start to finish. Now go ahead and get ready. And all I can say is, because you know Big Coach is one of them, like, there's no filter. He's from that cloth.
Yes, sir.
He said that to me, and I said, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. And I just walked off. I didn't know whether to laugh, get scared.
Fantastic.
All I did was bring the energy that whole game, because I was just scared. I was scared that Coach was going to bring me back to the side and have another word with me. And his voice is so powerful that when he spoke, my whole lungs just was rattling. And since then, every game he would talk to me. If he was waiting in the back for the elevator for getting his car, he would talk, young man, them jokes today was better, but you still got to get better. He said, a lot of energy tonight. I need some more next game. And then he would just talk to me. He said, you know, listen, we about to get in the regular season now. You got to turn it up for us. Yes, sir, big coach. I'm going to always miss big coach, but always be thankful for the fact that he was always noticing me out of anybody in the world, like a simple kid that loved basketball and was a host with a mic. He would give me pointers like he was coaching me, and I loved him for it. So
yeah, man, that's a terrific story, you know. And like I said before, Coach definitely appreciated the fact that you were there doing what you're doing, succeeding. And also Coach paid attention to all the details. So he felt that coaching you up to get the crowd into it was a part of his master plan for attending to all the details to help Georgetown be successful. So the fact that you were able to be a part of that, the fact that I was able to make my little contribution, man, we're blessed to be in that situation. Really appreciate you, bro. The knowledge that you brought to this conversation and the context and the background is tremendous. Great job, man. Appreciate you.
It's all on you. But before we go, if anybody want to follow you, any information on the book, give them some contact information on you, please.
Absolutely, man. No doubt, man. So, you know, I'm repping ESPN's The Undefeated, Race, Sports, and Culture, theundefeated.com. On Twitter, I'm at Jesse Washington, IG at Jesse John Washington. You know, you could follow along for, I'm bringing you that news, that information, that perspective, a couple dunks here and there from an old hooper, you know, and a couple jokes in it here and there. Got a couple films that we just had released a new film, a 30-minute documentary on Darnella Frazier, the young woman who filmed the death of George Floyd and changed the world. Yeah, if it was not for Darnella Frazier, this whole past year of racial awakening would never have happened. Who is she? What's she all about? What has she sacrificed in order to make that contribution to the advancement of Black people? Wow. It was my first directing documentary. It's on ESPN Plus. It's called Bearing Witness, a portrait of Darnella Frazier. So check that out. Salute to my people at The Undefeated. And you could find I Came as a Shadow, the autobiography of John Thompson, at your local Black independent bookstore near you.
To Mr. Jesse Washington, thank you so much for being a part of the Stoop. If there's anything we can ever do, please let us know. It's been a privilege and an honor to sit down and chat with you today. Like I said, as an author, as a basketball historian, as a visual conversationist, because that's what I got to call you now, because everything you said to me painted a picture in my mind. So you're a visual conversationist, sir. Thank you so much. And we greatly appreciate you.
Thank you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for another great episode of The Stoop. Until next time, we'll see you soon.